He kōna I purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Kia ora everyone, Ingrid here. Welcome to today's episode of Morning Report Essentials. Lots of big stories to chew over this morning. The school lunches really got people talking, including this comment, this sort of side comment really by ACT, that some of the sushi and the quinoa and other things that had been in the previous program were too woke and they'd be getting rid of that, which got us thinking, you know, is there such a thing as a woke food or not?
Well, there was a time when I didn't quite know how to pronounce. Was it quinoa?
Quinoa,
quinoa,
yes.
See, I couldn't even say it
because it's a tricky
one. Not how it's spelt, is it?
No,
perhaps that's
that was that. Yeah, should we're going to stick to food that we can spell? So a lot of feedback coming in on both sides of the argument about that. You know, what should be included in these new lunches? Also, bad news for lovers of kiwis and haters of stoats in Wellington, Corin.
Yeah, they're hunting down a rogue stoat, one male stoat that keeps popping up on cameras all over Miramar Peninsula. They've got a grid of cameras over there trying to hunt down these predators, and this one male stoat has not been found. So if you see it, do report it to Dan Henry. He's your man in Miramar.
Yeah, pop your headphones on, listen to the podcast and go on and find yourself a stoat if you are in Wellington. Do enjoy the episode.
Thousands of jobs could be on the line under the government's new school lunch model. The government says it will order what schools need from a central source rather than relying on the current 156 school lunch suppliers. Jan Karas is the owner of Jack's Cafe and makes 240 meals per day for two schools in the Coromandel. He joins us now. Kia ora, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, so your contract remains in place from what I can see until the end of the year, but after that, things could be uncertain for you.
Oh, very much so. You know, the changes they want to make, it doesn't seem correct. It doesn't work for us.
So what are you doing at the moment and what, you know, how does it work at the moment?
Basically, with the lunches, we've got a kids range from, say, 200 at one school, 30 at 40 at the other. We do such things as nachos, chicken mash, peas and gravy, cottage pie, sandwiches filled with ham and chicken. And they also get snacks of fruits, cheese and crackers, carrot sticks and hummus, which seems to be going down well. We consultate with the schools all the time and with the kids to see what they like. Obviously, there's some things that we can't do for them, but, you know, we try and make it as enjoyable as possible. With the new system that they're looking at, I don't see it being very enjoyable.
And cost-wise, so we're hearing the new model wants to go at about $3 a meal. You know, currently it's about $8. What are you able to do it for?
Look, at the end of the day, we are governed by, obviously, where we can buy the stock from. We're also governed by how much we pay wages to the staff for, and we've got packaging on top of that. Relatively speaking, you know, there is not much margin in the ranges that they got. You know, like at the end of the day, it's $5.80 for a young kid and $8.60-odd for the older kids. There is not much margin to move, especially with the prices in New Zealand at the present.
So this contract that you do, are you doing it because you want to, well, a number of reasons. One, you want to contribute to your community, but presumably this is something you can make a small profit from for your business.
Oh, of course, you know, and after the years of COVID and the cyclones and stuff like that, there was something that the business needed to do to, you know, keep moving forward. I've got staff that I need to keep employed. And at the end of the day, it's a livelihood that we need to keep running. It's something that we looked at. We have a cafe here as well, but obviously the cafe can't run when we're doing the school lunches. So I'm between a rock and a hard place. I either run the cafe or concentrate on the school lunches. At the end of the day, yes, you want to cut down costs and so forth, but at the end of the day, you're going to cut down the quality of the meals that the kids are going to get.
And you would have to presumably lay off staff if you didn't have this contract.
Yeah, I'll probably be laying off 3 to 4 staff.
The feedback on the meals you're delivering, is it good? I mean, the kids, are they receptive to these sort of more, you know?
Look, we have an uptake from the school. We've been given a spreadsheet of the uptake of school lunches. It ranges from anything from 70 up to around about 85% per day. Obviously, some kids don't like some of the meals. That's unfortunate, but we can't just change for a certain quantity. You know, everything is a standard across the board. But most of the feedback is pretty good. And, you know, there's going to be the odd occasion when it's not successful, so we look at changing that and we don't put that in our menu.
And what about this idea of a more scaled-back lunch being more appropriate, the sandwich and fruit model?
Well, at the end of the day, they do get sandwiches and they do get fruit just about every single day with the snack stuff. But what we're finding with the new model, I think they've done it the wrong way around. It's the older kids that are more conscious of what they eat and also particular about what they eat. If you're going to offer them tinned fruit, beans, bread, etc., they're not going to take up to that. Muesli bars also. It's just something they just don't want to eat. Some of them have got jobs, so they'll just go down to the local takeaway.
And look, I've got to ask, because ACT put it out there, I mean, this idea that sushi is somehow woke, what's your view on sushi?
Obviously, for us here, it's very hard for us to roll out that kind of amount of sushi because we don't have the areas to do that kind of stuff. I think sushi's good for the kids. You know, at the end of the day, it's something that they see in the shops all the time. You see a lot of the kids will buy those little packs of sushi from the supermarkets and so forth. And it's just the way that things are going. It's how do I put it? Like, the availability of those kind of foods to a lot of New Zealanders is a lot easier now than it used to be.
Junior doctors who have been striking this week are getting paid about twice as much per hour as they were 2 years ago. That's because of extra hours they're having to work because of workforce shortages, which of course are paid at a higher rate. The cost to taxpayers is more than $70 million annually. That's 2.5 times higher than at the peak of the COVID pandemic when doctors were working crazy hours. Phil Pennington has the story. He's with us now. Kia ora, good morning, Phil.
Morning, Ingrid.
So what is going on here? Are they working even crazier hours?
Well, it took us a whole year to get these figures from Te Whatu Ora. Don't know why there was such a big, long delay, but it was worth it in the sense that we see here, we get a glimpse in behind again of just the stresses the health system is under. The Junior Doctors Union said they've never seen figures like this before, and their response from Deborah Powell, the National Secretary, was, wow, this shows you just how bad things are. So what we see here is that junior doctors, of course, are under all sorts of pressure in their regular work week. I think they're doing like 50, 60 hours, but they're also called upon to plug the gaps. All the hospitals around the country have gaps at weekends in particular, and night shifts and evening shifts. And for those, they were paying a certain rate during COVID and there were problems then. Those gaps, though, just got worse. And then in 2022, what you see in June is that Te Whatu Ora recognises they can't go on and say they in fact almost double virtually the hourly rate that they're paying, and that does help. So now advance another 2 years and we see the effect of this here. Now there is some time lag in these figures, but what we see is that it has more than doubled the cost to taxpayers entirely. It hasn't completely solved the problem though, because Te Whatu Ora is telling us yesterday, no, we still have gaps. And these high rates, these high payments were actually meant to stop in the end of March, but they're carrying on with them. They're under review, but they're carrying on, and that shows you the extent of the problem.
Mm. Well, there's an irony here, isn't there? Because the junior doctors have been striking this week over pay, and they're getting paid twice as much as what they were before back in 2022. So, I mean, people might say, well, are they getting paid enough? What is going on here?
I said to the National Secretary, Deborah Powell, I said, are junior doctors creaming in it here? You know, they are 2,500 junior doctors out on strike on Tuesday and then another two-day strike coming up next week. We talked to someone on the picket line there who said, you know, we're such an undervalued but integral part of the hospital. And it is true that, you know, when Te Whatu Ora looks at this in 2022 and the rates they're paying, they realise, hey, that is not enough for the inconvenience and the effect on your life of not just working 60 hours a week, but then turning around and doing an extra night shift. Some of them are even doing up to two extra 8-hour shifts, so 16 hours at the weekends, that sort of thing. In terms of fatigue and people management, that just is unsustainable. Now, Deborah Powell, she obviously is in touch with her people. She says that, yes, it looks like doctors are getting well paid here. And the rates, if you look at them, are around averaged about 170. I mean, they vary a lot whether you're senior or junior and what you're doing in terms of a junior doctor and your experience. But that's probably $170 an hour for those the dark hour shifts, if you like. But Powell says this is a vicious cycle because they don't want to work these hours. They'd rather spend their time with their families. They're already overworked. But they do the hours because they know that if they don't do them, there won't be a doctor there. And the vicious cycle, of course, as you can see, Ingrid, here, is that what they're doing is they're plugging the gaps that there are at very high cost, and that is taking money away from regular pay rises to help retain staff. And Powell says until you can crack that nut and get retention and get the pay that you need to retain people, then we're going to be down this plug hole for some time. And you see that here because they have had to roll these things over.
Mm. Yeah, so what is Health New Zealand saying about that?
Well, they're saying that this is a really priority workforce for them, junior doctors. They say that they are focused on retaining retention, and they express a real solidarity with them and sympathy for them. They say that as a first step to boost training locally, they have added 50 new medical school places this year. So that is something. I mean, this is really, really tough. I mean, you see in Northland, for instance, they've got the biggest bill that's grown. They're at 3.9 times what they paid back in 2020. So 3.2 million in the last year versus only 840,000 the year before that. And that's not budgeted for. All the districts that came back to me said, we haven't budgeted for this, so this is unbudgeted. And this is a blowout at the very time as the other story we've been covering, Ingrid, of course, is that they've been told a couple of weeks ago, hey, you hospitals around the country, you have to save $105 million by the end of June on your personnel costs. So you've got these real dilemmas, there's real tension here. What are they going to do? We don't know where this is going to go, and there's this time lag. It'll be really interesting to see what the figures are for the last few months.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, data from Te Whatu Ora can be hard to come by, as we've found. This took a whole year to get.
Yeah, one of those directives was to get the overtime signed off, was it, to get sort of higher up authorisation for those extra hours. So maybe that will come into play too.
If you've been driving on Auckland's Southern Motorway, you may have seen a large billboard with the offer, Win a House. The raffle offers its winner a $2 million home, a brand new Tesla, $50,000 of furniture and a secret mystery prize. It sounds too good to be true, but its organiser is insistent he's for real, and it could help prevent suicides in the process. Katie Fitzgerald has been looking into this and joins us now. Good morning, Katie. What is the deal with this house?
Good morning. So, as you say, this is the prize in a mega raffle being run by a new charity called the Suicide Reduction Trust. The house is in the Auckland suburb of Flatbush, and it's currently half built. I drove past it recently, and at the moment, it's mostly framing and scaffolding. The house will have 6 bedrooms, 4.5 bathrooms, 2 kitchens, and multiple living areas. It's listed by 2 agents from Harcourts, and according to their website, it's currently under contract. That contract is with the Suicide Reduction Trust, a new charity that was founded in February this year. Dave Jacks runs that charity. He says the purchase of the house and a Tesla is conditional on the raffle successfully selling enough tickets to cover the cost. Here's what he had to say to me about it when I asked.
It's easier to pay for the house once the raffle's completed. If the raffle generates $5 million, for example, then the raffle proceeds can be used to purchase the house. If the raffle only generates $1 million of proceeds, then you're better off to cancel the raffle and refund everyone's money than you are to complete an exercise that didn't work out.
Okay, so the raffle proceeds will be used to buy the house, and then whatever is left afterwards will go towards the trust.
Absolutely.
And as I said earlier, the purchase of the house is conditional on the raffle raising enough money to also help get the Suicide Reduction Trust off the ground.
Okay, what is the Suicide Reduction Trust then?
First of all, let's not confuse this with the Life Matters Suicide Prevention Trust, which has been running since 2014. As I mentioned earlier, the Suicide Reduction Trust was founded in February, and according to its website, it wants to provide therapies focused on the future and self-acceptance to try and prevent suicides. On its website, it says it's accepting expressions of interest for providers to offer the therapies. And if you look at the raffle online, you'll see plenty of feedback from people praising the work the charity is doing and the difference it's making. Mr. Jack says it hasn't actually started providing any services, though, and the raffle is the start of a big fundraising effort before beginning work.
It's more efficient or effective to be noticed in a louder way than a quieter way. It's very expensive to make a meaningful difference on reducing suicide nationally, and to do it on $100,000 versus $1 million, like for $100,000 you'd be ineffective. You wouldn't be able to do anything. We've managed to get enough money together to fund the raffle and the marketing of the raffle, but we are unable to get enough money together to fund Suicide Reduction Trust annually ongoing. It's the same cost to set up, for example, the conversational chatbot, to do it locally as it is nationally. So you get economies of scale doing it nationally.
So what is Dave Jacks talking about when he mentions this conversational chatbot?
Well, as you know, they're popping up in a lot of areas these days, including psychology. Mr. Jacks says it's a great option for his charity, and he just needs a medical professional to teach it and a programming expert to make it work. Mr. Jacks says they don't have a preferred vendor for the chatbot yet, but he has been looking into it. He also says once the raffle is done and the Suicide Reduction Trust is running, it won't be aiming to provide services to people experiencing suicidal ideation. It will be working with people at a lower level, potentially even with no mental health issues, and providing them the therapies so in the future they have a lower chance of experiencing suicidal ideation.
Right, so to be clear, the Suicide Reduction Trust, it doesn't have any clinical staff as yet, and it's planning to use chatbots to help prevent suicide.
Yeah.
Okay, so the trust is being described as a charity. Is that the case?
Yes and no. It's not an official registered charity. Mr. Jack says it has a pending status. I asked the Department of Internal Affairs about that, and they said a pending status does not exist. I put that to Mr. Jacks, and this is what he had to say.
So we've got the email advising they've got all the complete documents, but they haven't told us yes or no yet. So what do you call the status we're in? We're awaiting the outcome of our application. Our application is pending.
Mr. Jack said once that approval comes through, the registration will be backdated. The DIA agrees with that and says all applications are backdated to the last time they are asked to provide any information, which could either be when they first applied or when extra information was requested. It's worth noting that charities don't need to be registered to be called a charity, though. You've probably noticed we've been calling the Suicide Reduction Trust a charity throughout this piece. It's being registered can help you with tax privileges or securing funding and volunteers, though.
And the raffle, is that legitimate?
Yes. The raffle is sanctioned by the Department of Internal Affairs. The Suicide Reduction Trust has got a Class 3 gambling licence to operate it. That's what you need if you were going to run a raffle with a prize of over $5,000. And it will be drawn by a police officer at the end of June.
Educators who think they can't speak freely on contentious academic issues will now have a support group. The Free Speech Union has launched a professional membership category, especially for academics. Given the union's libertarian leanings, it may be a more attractive deal to scholars on the political right. But Dr. Paul Moon, a historian at AUT, who is one of the two chairpeople of the group's new academic chapter, insists it is open to all. He joins us now to tell us more. Kia ora, good morning.
Kia ora.
Why is this academic chapter needed in the Free Speech Union?
There have been 2 years of polling now which show that a majority of academics in some cases feel that they're not free to speak on their areas of expertise because they fear various forms of censorship or penalty. This is a tertiary-wide survey, and so this union exists really to protect those rights, to give them certainty that the legal rights they have to be a critic and conscience of society can be protected.
So how would it offer that protection?
Well, there's an annual membership, I think it's about $200 fee, and it provides professional advice, legal advice. It can advocate for people, it can mediate. There are various options available. The idea is not to be adversarial in any way, but really to be collaborative, to work with institutions to ensure that free speech can survive.
So in terms of what academic or what freedom there should be to say what people want to say, given academics' responsibilities at the tertiary institutions to be a critic and conscience of society, what can they or should they be able to say?
Most academics have careers that have been built up over several years, and they're professionals and they're experts in their various fields. If they do research and their research reveals certain things, they should be able to announce that. They should be able to provide some informed commentary on political issues. Your introduction mentioned that this was potentially a right-leaning initiative. It really isn't. It's designed to protect all academics. And there are many academics who might identify themselves as being on the left who equally feel that they're not free to express certain views. So it's an egalitarian approach designed to protect everyone's rights.
What are the kind of views that they don't feel able to express at the moment?
We don't know because they don't express them. This is one of the things that the poll found, is that they said they feel uncomfortable giving voice to certain views, sometimes based on research, sometimes commentary issues, because they fear there might be a form of penalty attached to that.
Is there a line, do you think, between free speech and a view and then hate speech or problematic views that shouldn't be expressed?
Absolutely, and the law provides for that. So if you incite violence, if you encourage someone to commit a criminal act, those things are reprehensible, obviously, and they're illegal, and the law provides penalties for that. So there is that line already in place.
And the academics would be, in this case, it's protecting the freedom for them to talk about their areas of expertise, or it goes beyond that?
It would orbit around their areas of expertise. It might extend more broadly. But the other side of the coin, of course, is if they do express these views, they have to be prepared for others to counter them, to disprove them, and so on. So it's not an unbridled freedom. There are potential consequences of expressing your views in the sense that people might disprove you or disagree with you. That's part of the deal.
Do you think, though, that when people do express views, if they are considered problematic by others, I mean, that there is going to be some pushback regardless? How much protection would this offer?
Well, it depends on what constitutes problematic. If problematic tends to be a euphemism for something others might disagree with, that's the basis of it being problematic, and that's not really a good criterion to silence speech. If you regard something as problematic, you point out why it's wrong.
Okay.
You could imagine the same thing applying to journalists, for example. Imagine if they had the same restrictions of not being able to ask certain questions because the interviewee regarded them as problematic. That wouldn't work, and really it's the same sort of rights we want for academics.
Every Kiwi's worst nightmare, it is lurking in the shadows of Miramar Peninsula in the capital. It is a male stoat, the arch-enemy of Kiwi chicks and an all-purpose eco-villain. The first to be spotted on the peninsula too, since the pest was eliminated from the area late last year. The stoat has been picked up several times on the area's extensive grid of cameras. Dan Henry is the leader of Predator Free Miramar. Hi, Dan.
Kia ora, Corin.
I imagine you'll be taking this very personally because Miramar has a great track record at hunting down these predators.
That's right. We are taking it personally, and we will be leaving no stone unturned finding this little critter. It was first seen on camera just before Christmas, and we've got cameras basically every hectare or so across the peninsula. Well, not every 4 hectares, perhaps, across the peninsula. There are lots of them, and he's made appearances 12 times since then, but we haven't managed to coax him into a trap. So we are upping our game and upskilling our volunteers, and we're going to try and track him down.
So he's a clever little stoat.
Oh, yeah, and they are. And that's the thing. We've changed the landscape so markedly in eastern Wellington that, he's got the run of the place. He's just running around across 1,000 hectares, living his best life, unencumbered by any competition. So, possibly behaving quite differently to other stoats in other parts of the country.
Now, it's a small consolation, right, that it is a male. You think it is a male, therefore less likely to be breeding other sneaky stoats.
That's right. That's why stoats are such a terrible predator for our native fauna, because they, by the time the females leave the den, they are pregnant and they have the potential to become, a dozen other stoats just like that. So the fact that it's a male, and we've identified that through the photos, is a bit of a blessing, and we've got time on our side. So, they don't nest until spring, so we've got a few months. And this is a sort of a scalpel operation, not a sledgehammer. So we've just got to sort of line our traps up in the right places and offer the right lures and keep our camera network ticking over so that we can continue to hone in on where he's travelling.
So what's the message to people who have got cameras and who are out there spotting? Get onto it fast.
And just shout out, let us know, 0800 no rats, or they can email predatorfreemiramar@gmail.com. predatorpredators.com. They can jump on Facebook. They'll find me. People know how to reach me. And Predator Free Wellington's eradication team, you know, they've got a hungry staff of 30-odd people out there who will come and turn up and, you know, put a dog around the place and see if they can track it to where it's hanging out. So, yeah, just be vigilant. That's the name of the game here.
Time now for sport at 23 minutes to 9 with Nathan Lodardi. Kia ora, Nathan.
Kia ora.
A bit of controversy in the marathon world today?
There is controversy in the marathon world around length. The Newport Marathon. What's happened is the organisers have come out and said, you know how you felt, man, it feels like I'm nearly at the end and I'm not. Well, yeah, they got it wrong. They measured it wrong by 276 metres. So they've gone out, they said, look, we're going to amend people's times. However, I don't think it mattered that much because Chris Bird, who won the race, he actually ran it, he set a new course record when he did it. So I imagine what that means, he ran it in 2 hours 31:34. I imagine what that means is that will now come in. Well, how long would you go? 276 metres, about another minute out of that. So he's now got a personal best. So that's what's happened there in Newport. However, a marathon in Fountain Valley, a guy called Esteban Prado, he's 24 years old. He's been training for marathons. He's just got into them recently and he's actually got some incredible skill. What he doesn't have is much knowledge of what's supposed to happen. So he wins the marathon and then is instantly disqualified because they said, this is what the race director said, we were forced to disqualify a participant after it was confirmed they received unauthorised assistance from an individual on a bicycle. What that was his dad who rode along and gave him a water bottle to drink. And when they said, well, why did you do that? He said, whenever I got to those stations, the volunteers, they were scrambling because I was the only runner in sight. You could barely see me like at certain turns because what he's saying is I was so fast that these people weren't ready for me. The race was awarded to the second place getter who finished quite a bit behind him. And Esteban Prado, this is a good bit of pride in this answer. Mm. I don't argue over something that's 15 minutes away from you. You get no money or anything. If he wanted that, congratulations for that first place. If he really felt like he needed it, it's just for him at the end of the day. I really got nothing out of it. I know I won.
Jesus. Hey, how hard can it be to measure a marathon?
I know, measure out a marathon.
Yeah, but it's on your phone. I mean, you walk around and it tells you how many steps you're doing. I mean, it can't be that. You get your map, my run, and you put it into a little.
It's quite thrilling for people to find out their marathon time's going to be even faster. So that's quite.
Well,
quite
I've done one once, and I want to go back and have a check.
Oh, my goodness.
It took me about 4 hours.
Yeah, there you go.
And that's today's Morning Report podcast.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Do tune in tomorrow wherever you get your podcasts from. The Little Spotted Kiwi. RNZ National.